Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe, and in weak voice, so do bear with me this hour as we go through a parade of guests. Today, I'm pleased to bring you several fascinating artists, several of whom are facing challenges bringing their artistry into the world. Mezzo-soprano Lori Rubin is opening the 10th season of Music at Meyer this coming Monday. She'll be joined by phone from Hawaii shortly, along with Mike Tilkulski, who's the producer of the Music at Meyer series. He'll tell us more about the full season. Cellist Joan Jean-Renaud and fellow collaborators Sid Perlman and Denise Lito are presenting a multidisciplinary work at ODC this weekend and in Santa Cruz next weekend called Your Body is Not a Shark, which deals with the unexpected and expected effects of health and aging on performing artists. And British composer Robin Holloway is here. He's featured next week with the San Francisco Symphony as the composer of Ocean Voyage, next week's multimedia, multi-composer production based on Henrik Ibsen's Peer Gynt. He also orchestrated Debussy's settings of the poems of Paul Verlaine, which will be sung by Renee Fleming with MTT and the Symphony tonight and this weekend. And Peter Robinson brings us a touch of Downton Abbey fever to round things out. Stay with us. Any one of these guests could easily occupy a full hour of Open Air, so I apologize in advance that these chats will be brief, with the hope of a return visit for something in depth more down the road. Music by composer Joan Jean-Renaud from Your Body is Not a Shark, having its world premiere at the ODC this weekend. It's a performance piece encompassing dance, live music, and sound collage, which uses physical limitation and difference as a point of departure for examining the creative process. The collaborators on Shark include four women, ages 41 to 55, one with multiple sclerosis, another with laryngeal dystonia, and asks the question, what happens when we stumble, when our words won't come out, when the body stutters? Shark explores this question through a series of dances, each based on a poem by Denise Lito, who joins me in studio along with composer Joan Jean-Renaud and choreographer Sid Perlman. Welcome.
Thank you.
Cellist and composer Joan Jean-Renaud has been involved in music for over 40 years, most notably for 20 of those years as cellist with the Kronos Quartet. She's now involved in solo and collaborative projects in composition, improvisation, electronics, as well as multidisciplinary performance. She's written more than 50 compositions for cello and small ensembles, and her 2008 CD, Strange Toys, was nominated for a Grammy Award. Joan, welcome back to KLW.
It's nice to be back.
Denise Lito is a poet and senior editor at the University of California, Berkeley. She works with a poetics of multidisciplinary practice, with the poetics of multidisciplinary practice and engagement, the effects of language making, speech formation, prosody, and movement within a framework of disruption and variation, where the collaboration is as important as the emergent room. The emergent work, and particularly relevant to the work she's collaborating on, Your Body is Not a Shark, is she suffers from laryngeal dystonia, a condition which makes it sometimes hard for her to speak. So her voicer, in case of that need today, is the choreographer for Your Body is Not a Shark, Sid Perlman. Denise, welcome. Sid, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Good to be here.
And our final introduction, from 1991 to 99, Sid Perlman was the artistic director of San Francisco's critically acclaimed Nesting Dolls Dance Company. In 1999, she relocated to Los Angeles, establishing herself as an independent choreographer and curator. In addition to her own works, Perlman has choreographed for film, opera, and theater, and she currently teaches at UC Santa Cruz and Cabrillo College. I'd like to start the conversation with cellist and composer of Your Body Is Not a Shark, Joan Jean Renault, no stranger to these airwaves, as you've been a past guest, I think, of Then and Now, as well as of Alan Farley's for Open Air. Now, before we talk about this collaborative work, I'd like you to first share with us how multiple sclerosis has affected your life as a musician.
Well, it's changed my career path, but I think in a good way. Of course, people know me really as the cellist of Kronos for those 20 years that I was with the group, which was 78 to 98. And when I discovered that I had multiple sclerosis, I decided that it would be a good idea to stop touring because Kronos has such a rigorous schedule.
And when was that discovery, John?
So I know I had my first episode in 96, but I was not diagnosed until the beginning of 98. And then I left Kronos at the very end of 98. But that was an interesting process because when I left the group, I realized, well, you know, there have been things that I have not been able to do within the group, improvisation being one of them particularly, that I've always wanted to concentrate more on that I've never had the chance to do because I was, of course, so busy with Kronos all the time. So it was great. So it gave me the opportunity to start improvising more, and that quickly led to composing. I have a bunch of composer friends, obviously, you know, after all those years with Kronos and working with so many different people and getting to know several of them very well.
I suppose if you had a Rolodex in this day and age, it would be quite full.
that was great. And that is one of the reasons I think I was able to start to compose is because I had played so many works with Kronos and worked with these composers. And so it really gave me an insight into how, you know, there's such a variety of music out there and how there's so many different approaches to how you can compose. And so that was really encouraging for me. And there's particularly one composer, Steve Mackey, who teaches at Princeton, and we're exactly the same age, and we've been really good friends, and he wrote a bunch of stuff for Kronos, and he plays electric guitar, and he's a great improviser, a great composer, and I think he actually inspired me a lot, and that was one of the first things he told me. He said, well, if you start improvising, pretty soon you're going to start composing, and that's exactly what happened.
And so other performances here in the Bay Area have included something of Barbara Higbee's recently as well.
Yeah, that's true. It was great. We had a great fun with Barbara. She did a little series for Yoshi's over in the East Bay and included me on this her last programs there.
You're the composer of this work that's going to be at ODC this weekend. Your Body Is Not a Shark. Now, please tell us a little bit about that title.
Oh, gosh. Well, I think Sid and Denise would be the perfect one to tell you about the title. But to me, I could relate to it so well because basically, in a nutshell, for me, it was like, well, you don't have your body is not, you don't need to be afraid of your body, you know.
And you only have so much control over it, for that matter.
And this is true. And that's what you find out. And so instead of fighting against it, I think it's better to, in a way, embrace it. And then realize, okay, that's just going to take me in a different direction. What are the things that I can still do? There's things that maybe I can't do so much anymore or do as well, but there's a lot of other opportunities out there that I can apply my creative abilities towards.
Well, Denise Lito, who is the poet of these works, Your Body Is Not a Shark, tell me about the selection of the poetry. Was it written specifically for this piece, or are they selected from among your works?
They are all original pieces that were written expressly for Shark.
Fantastic. And they're dealing with all sorts of different aspects of the human body. I'm wondering, there are six different dances. Maybe we can talk with Sid Perlman about the dancers that are involved.
Absolutely. It's an intergenerational cast of dancers from 18 to 63. And Denise has written 6 poems for us to work with. And so our process was to get deeply engaged with the poetic structure, not following our normal trajectory into making a dance, but the tanka, sestina, ulipo. Denise provided us with an explanatory text of how the poem works, and we use that as a map for creating the dance, reacting both and engaging both with Joan's score, the text of Denise's poem, and then the explanatory text as a map.
So as an explanation, it's not necessarily that Denise's poems are being set to music. It's that some of them are spoken as well as being orchestrated, so to speak.
They are. Joan actually recorded Denise's voice throughout, so Denise's voice works as a sound collage in many of the different sections. There's a little tiny bit of spoken text by the dancers, but the primary voice that you hear is Denise's, speaking her own words, and she's also on stage throughout as one of the performers. We worked structurally. For example, in a concrete poem, what's most important is not only the text, but what the words look like on the page. And so not only were we dealing with what the content of the poem was, but imagining what it would be like to create those lines and spaces on the page as if you were taking an aerial snapshot of the dance space. In the tanka, which is a 5-line poem somewhat similar to a haiku, we learned how to embody the punctuation. And Denise gave us an explanatory text of how that worked so that within the tanka section, there's actually 5 small tankas because it's a small poem that create sort of a mosaic and puzzle.
Denise, since this work is dealing with disability or differently abled people in whatever way, I'm wondering if all of the poems were inspired by your own laryngeal dystonia or whether it's inspired by other elements.
It's a kind of complicated set of inspirations. And certainly for Your Body is Not a Shark, I was thinking expressly about dystonia and about MS as I was writing. But it's not a literal capturing of those conditions. It's sort of kind of gesturing toward them and touching kind of the edges of them, and then kind of trying to look at the experience of moving through the world with those conditions and capturing them aesthetically.
But it's also as much about taking issues around the body and difference as a way to think about how you can work from within side limitations. So it's not specifically a piece that is about the disabled body or about disability, but thinking of it more as a process and how we are able to create, invent, find new things when limitations are imposed upon us.
Let's hear a little bit from this work. Joan, perhaps you could set up this track for us.
Yeah, so I think we're going to listen to This Is Not a Duet, which in fact sort of is a duet, because you'll hear me playing the cello, and Willie Why Not plays the vibraphone. And this also has Denise's voice, and I believe that is the name of, what was the name of the poem of This Is Not a Duet? Was it This Is Not a Duet?
This Is Not a Poem, I think, was the name of the poem.
Okay.
So we called it This Is Not a Duet, and we condensed it.
Gets all, our titles have gone through many transitions, so it's always hard to remember which one's which. But this, but it has Denise's voice, and it also has some sound elements on there, too.
Let's hear a little bit. This is from Your Body is Not a Shark, music composed by my guest, Joan John Renaud.
Anatomy narrative, the brain reroutes matter, aspects of the body, indeterminacy, so that its movement, the brain reroutes matter, so that its movement is the same as its touch, not art as the limit, aspects of the body, the same as its touch. Concentration, alertness, pain, but rather when the limit out of the anatomy narrative, before anything is created, the thinking that occurs, but rather when the limit becomes the art, every nuance indeterminate, the whole piece, water worn away by becomes the art, the whole piece, transcription, incantation, curse, as though drowning were nearer.
Those are the words and voice of poet Denise Leto. Music by Joan Renault, cellist and composer. You'll be hearing her perform cello. Joan, who else is performing as part of the ensemble?
So, he was on Woodblocks, but Willie Wynot, who's a great percussionist.
Fantastic, yes.
Yeah, and I've done a lot of work with Willie over the years. And then there's also the Cadenza Orchestra, it's a 7-piece string section.
Fantastic. And in a fantastic space this weekend, the ODC space on 17th Street. Fellow collaborator Sid Perlman, Denise Leto, I wish you a wonderful performance this weekend. And thank you for taking some time here on Open Air.
Thank you
so much for having us.
The performances, the world premiere of Your Body is Not a Shark at the ODC Theater is tomorrow through Sunday. Details at odctheater.org. And next week, the 17th through the 20th, at Motion at the Mill on Front Street in Santa Cruz. And if you want a little road trip down to Santa Cruz, you can see an excellent performance. Go to their website to find out a little bit more. SantaCruzDance.com. Still to come here on Open Air, a conversation with Robin Holloway and with Lori Rubin, mezzo-soprano. Stay tuned to Open Air. My next guest on Open Air is mezzo-soprano Lori Rubin. She's been lauded by the New York Times for her compelling artistry and communicative power. She will open the 10th season of the Music Admire concert series at San Francisco's Congregation Emmanuel this Monday, which will feature songs by Fauré, Sibelius, Gershwin, Bernstein, Richard Rogers, as well as two San Francisco premieres based on Ms. Rubin's writings, Do You Dream in Color, recounting her experiences as a blind opera singer. And she joins me now by phone from Hawaii. Hi, Lori.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, great to hear you. Have you on from long distance here.
I know.
Now, to a certain and certainly lesser degree, we're on an even footing for this interview, as I can't see you, and you wouldn't be able to see me even if you were here.
Exactly. Well, well put.
I will tell you, though, that I will be looking at a couple of notes that I jotted down as we talk.
Sure.
First of all, about this concert, how did you choose the works for the program?
For this concert, it was pretty straightforward because my memoir just came out about my life as a blind artist, and also because my CD, Do You Dream in Color, just came out. And I really am so excited about performing, especially the San Francisco premieres, because it's been a dream to share with audiences what my life is like as a blind artist. And you don't get to always do that in an audition or even when you're in a concert setting, but here I can now share this poem that talks about my life making jewelry and being on stage and all sorts of things, and even challenges the audience about whether they dream in color. And so, and also to do this in such a visceral way is really, really, really special.
Well, let's back
so
up
that,
a moment.
That sort of that part of the program was really straightforward.
Well, if we could back up just for a moment there on about your book, Do You Dream in Color? The different sections of your book are actually titled for different colors. Now, how does your perception of color, which you can't see, play into your music?
Well, you know, I've always heard about synesthesia, where, you know, we associate colors with sounds or tastes with touch, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think from an early age, because I had perfect pitch and also associating it with music, with whatever the mood of the day was, it really, they connected. So, for example, for some reason, green to me say it sounds like A major, and blue sounds like the Mixolydian mode. I don't know why, but brown, like B flat, chocolate, sort of B flat. I think also color, I always joke with people that I feel like in a past life I could see, because I really understand color and I don't know how to explain it. But when somebody says blue, some image of blue comes to mind, and I'm not sure if it's what they're seeing, but I definitely have a visual in my head. And so in music, definitely, it's really interesting, because when Bruce Adolph wrote the Do You Dream in Color piece, a lot of those colors naturally seemed to, like, the colors were exactly what I would have pictured as well. It makes me wonder how closely related the visual is to the auditory. And, you know, in my book, definitely, I talked about color because I wanted the sighted reader to feel that, for example, red would relate to something in my life. And sure enough, it related to this time that I sang with John Williams in a red gown, and I made this statement on stage in bright red. And blue, or actually I'm trying to think of another color offhand, black being the color of my seeing eye dog at the time, or rather guide dog at the time.
Hmm. Now, yeah. What is did you write the music that the words are set to for this particular recital for the excerpts from Do You Dream in Color, or who's the composer?
The composer is Bruce Adolph, who maybe some of your listeners know from The Piano Puzzlers. He does the piano. but he's a fantastic composer in his own right, and he wrote the entire setting of the piece. And it came about because he just asked me one day, will you, Lori, can I write a song cycle for you, and can you write a poem about being blind? And at first I thought, oh, I don't want it to be hokey, I don't want it to be cheesy, you know, it could be all this sappy stuff about what people think blindness is about. But then I realized what I wanted to write about, so he got quite an earful, and he's like, oh, okay, we're going to have to set this in a 20-minute song cycle. So it's a very long, kind of cantata-like piece.
Well, as I mentioned, there's also music of Fauré, Sibelius, and George Gershwin, and Bernstein. Now, the program will be introduced by Frederica von Stade. Tell us about your friendship with Flicka, as she's affectionately known.
Yes. She is a wonderful person. And actually, I met her a long time ago. I think it was 1997. I was a senior in high school. And my voice teacher at the time was a woman named Shigemi Matsumoto, who was very close friends with Flicka. And she asked my mom to pick Flicka up from a location and to take her to a masterclass that Flicka had agreed to do for my teacher students. So we got some wonderful time with her in the car, and we just got to see what a lovely, wonderful person she was. And a couple years later, when I was a sophomore in college, my mother shamelessly gave her a CD when she went to the Met. At one point, she went to see, I think it was a production of The Merry Widow, and she went backstage and gave Flicka a CD of my recent concert.
Lori, as a flutist, I wish I had a mother like you.
It's nice to have somebody promoting you, because it's so hard to do it yourself. But she was wonderful, and she, you know, a couple months later, we didn't hear anything for a couple months, because I didn't expect to hear anything at all. But all of a sudden, I get this call from, well, it's a long story, but anyway, I ended up speaking with her. She wanted to ask me if I could sing a duet concert with her for a blindness benefit for a friend of hers. But, you know, the way she asked me, it wasn't like you would be expecting a call from this, you know, opera singer. She just sounded like somebody who was asking if somebody would do her a favor for a Girl Scout troop. You know, it was very like, well, if you don't mind, and, you know, I was like, give me 5 minutes to pack. Of course I'll sing a duet concert with you. And it was just an incredible weekend. But I think the most incredible thing, there were two things. The first thing was that I was a young singer with young technique, let's just say. And when I sang with her, like, I was nervous about her blowing me out of the water. But what ends up happening when you're singing with somebody better than you is that you usually will rise to the occasion. Your voice, the technique, and everything will just naturally match the person you're with. And it was probably one of the biggest growth experiences of my life was to sing a duet with her. And then the second thing that was so remarkable about her was that what was even more important to her than career and the music was her family. And even you go to her local ice cream shop, and then people knew her, like, because she would go in there and she would talk about their kids. And it was just, it made me realize that that's the kind of person I wanted to be. I didn't want to just be some diva. I wanted to be somebody who community was important to, because that's who I am anyway. And so I've never lost sight of that. And that's probably why I ended up here in Hawaii too, because I wanted to be close to family. My partner's family lives here. And it's really been important to me, and I'm so grateful to her friendship, and she's been such a great mentor to me.
So she'll be introducing the concert this Monday at Congregation Emmanuel Music Admire concert. That's going to be at 7:30 this coming Monday. I understand you also count Kenny Loggins as a fan.
Oh, Kenny Loggins is incredible. When I was 4 years old, my mom used to play his music all the time in the car. She was just obsessed with his music. So I became obsessed with his music. And apparently he was my imaginary friend in the nap room of of preschool. And she happened to meet him at a supermarket, because we both had houses in Encino. And he was touched by the fact that this four-year-old blind person was into his music. So he asked us to come to his concert and to come backstage, and that snowballed into us becoming groupies, and we went backstage. We had a condo in Tahoe, so we used to go whenever he'd perform at Caesar's Palace. He taught me how to water ski, essentially, because we went on a water skiing trip with him, and I was sort of sitting in the speedboat going, I want to ski, I want to ski. So he got a teacher on board, and there's some great pictures we have of me skiing, and he's taking pictures.
That's terrific. Now,
I saw him in concert, and so we still do know each other, and he's really wonderful.
That's great. I would love to spend an hour with you. You have so much to talk about, but I just do want to touch on one other thing, if you'd take a little bit of time with me.
Of course.
Think most conductors would consider working with a blind singer a real challenge. Now, this is going to be a recital, so you're kind of free from having to pay attention to a baton, but how do you pay attention to a baton if you're a soloist in front of an orchestra? How do you communicate with the conductor?
Well, I'll start with the obvious and say that most conductors want a singer or an instrumentalist to really know the music backwards and forwards, so that they're not necessarily depending on waving of their arms and, cueing. Of course, it's very important. But I've always had conductors say to me how wonderful that they don't have to worry about that with me, that I'm not going to overly use them as a crutch. But I also think what it is, too, is that conductors are so vocal. They don't even realize it, but they're going to take a breath with you. They're going to do a little bit of Glenn Gould in there. They're going to make some grunting noises. And it's really helpful. And it's actually, when I did the Barber Knoxville Summer of 1915 with John Williams.
Wonderful work.
It was amazing, yeah, but feeling his energy near me was really what did it, and it was the sound of his arms, it was the sound of his breathing, and you can also feel the energy from a person. It's very, their aura, and I know it sounds kind of, a little strange to say that, but you can feel it, and so we were always in sync, and I've never had a problem following a conductor, and we've always had it, and it's also about communication, because if we're not together, then the conductor just says, well, I actually want to take a faster tempo here. Can we do this? And so there's maybe a little bit more verbal communication, but I've never had a problem. And actually, there was one time that I was supposed to sing the national anthem at a very big fundraising event. It was Madeleine Albright was there, and for the Harry Truman Library. And the Marine Band, we didn't get the memo to people that I was supposed to sing and the Marine Band was supposed to play, but we didn't know we were supposed to do it together. And the sergeant was like, I'm sorry, we don't play for singers, but they had already hired both of us. So I just said, hey, let's just see if we can do it together. And they said, well, we don't give an intro, and they were just very strict. And we did a couple of times, and then I realized I could time when I came in with their salutes. And when I did the event that night, everything went well, because I, again, their salutes were so rhythmic. And again, I was able to follow him. And afterwards, he said to me, don't worry, we'll accompany you anytime you want to sing with us. So, it's just, it's fear in the beginning. But then afterwards, I think people realize that there's a lot more to conducting than just using your eyes.
That's a wonderful story, Lori, and I wish you every success on Monday's concert at Music
Thank
at
you.
Meyer Concert Series, opening the 10th season, and have a safe flight from Hawaii. Mezzo-soprano Lori Rubin, who will be performing this coming Monday, January 14th, at Congregation Emmanuel's 375-seat Martin Meyer Sanctuary. That's at 2 Lake Street in San Francisco. And now I'm joined by another person associated with the Music at Meyer Concert Series, producer Mike Tucholsky. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to KLW.
Thank you, David. Thanks for having me.
So Lori is starting the 10th season of Music at Meyer. Could you tell us in a capsule a little bit about the rest of the season?
Well, yeah, it is our 10th season, and so we have an amazing lineup of performers. Jake Heggie will be with us January 28th with Carol Wincents playing flute. She's one of the country's, or maybe the world's, greatest known flute players right now. And on March 11th, we have the Lee Trio, and they're going to play the Mendelssohn D minor piano trio, their wonderful piano trio. David Burgess will be playing guitar on March 18th, and he specializes in all kinds of Brazilian guitar music, so lots of Joe Beam music, so Bossa Nova fans should feel free to join us for that one. Every year we have the San Francisco Opera Center Adler Fellows, and so their performance will be April 15th, and then April 29th, an amazing pianist from Taiwan, Ang Lee, not the director Ang Lee, but Ang Lee, L-I, and she's going to play some really amazing tunes for, or songs for piano, Schumann's Kinderszenen and Debussy's Children's Corner, so bring the whole family.
And then it looks like to round things out in May, cantor Rosalind Barak, who is a force to be reckoned with for this entire series, is being featured in May.
Yes, cantor Barak's the artistic director, and she started the series 10 years ago, along with Flicka, who she asked to help boost the opening performance, and Flicka not only performed, but really inaugurated the series, so it's great to come full circle with her this year.
And she'll be, Flicka will be introducing this coming Monday's concert with blind mezzo-soprano Lori Rubin. I'm sorry we don't have more time for you, Mike, but you can find out more information about the full series at emmanuelsf.org, everything for the Music at Meyer Concert Series. Mike, thanks for taking a little time today.
Thank you so much, David.
You're listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Composer Robin Holloway joins me now in studio. He's visiting from his hometown of Cambridge, England, and is in San Francisco for two events with Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony. Tonight and this weekend, we'll see the world premiere of C'est l'extase
Holloway's new San Francisco commissioned orchestration of Debussy's settings of the poems of Paul Verlaine, sung by Renee Fleming with Michael Tilson Thomas conducting. And next week we'll see the first performance of his work Ocean Voyage as part of a semi-staged multimedia production of Ibsen's Peer Gynt. Robin, welcome to KLW.
Thank you.
You are no stranger to these shores for sure, and you've forged quite a deep relationship with MTT and the symphony. Could you tell us how that collaboration began?
Well, I think it must have begun when I met him in England, I suppose back in the 1980s. He did a lot of work in England and for some time was chief conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra there before coming back to the States. So our friendship began then. But once he was in charge here in San Francisco, he was able to put into action with a fine orchestra at his disposal, all kinds of things that he really wanted to do. And as everyone around here knows, he's a person of enormously eclectic and omnivorous sort of tastes. He just loves so many different kinds of things and has the opportunity to put them into practice around here. So I'm just one facet of his generous interest in so many things.
Tonight's performance, as well as this weekend's, will see the world premiere of this orchestration of Debussy. Tell me how you came to these particular poems of Verlaine.
Well, this was an idea originating with MTT himself. I wouldn't have thought of it otherwise, but he sort of ran it past me, and I thought about it a bit, and eventually grew into it. It became more and more attractive, especially dangling before me René Fleming to sing them. That was part of the allure as well.
Certainly carrot, more carrot than stick there.
Yes, yes.
Fantastic.
So I thought, the young Debussy set a lot of Verlaine. I think there's about 25 settings in all, some of them still unpublished, some of them published after his lifetime because they're juvenilia. And some famous collections published during his lifetime and popular ever since. And at first I thought I'd range widely among these, but then I whittled it down. 10 songs, 6 of which he gathered together as one work, and 4 outside that sort of group, making 10 in all, but not in his order, making a new kind of composite work out of the 10, and linking them together with little transitions of my own, and finally quite a big bit of original music based upon the songs, sort of setting off a kind of epilogue for the whole work.
Mm. Those programs tomorrow and this weekend will also include Debussy's Je and La Mer, as well as René singing the selections from the Chants d'Auvergne of Cantilupe.
Indeed,
a beautiful,
yes.
Program.
Very, very lovely. Yeah.
Now, let me move ahead a week. I'd like to think that most listeners are familiar with the Peer Gynt story, but speaking from a very narrow experience myself, Edvard Grieg's orchestral suite, maybe you could enlighten us a bit about this fascinating character of Gynt. It's been described as the story of a life based on procrastination and avoidance, something that I can certainly relate to.
We can all relate to procrastination and avoidance. Yes, yes. But perhaps you can't relate to the sort of things that Peer did as a young man which caused the total outrage of the society he lived in, which compelled him to leave his native country as a young man and travel the world for all the years of his prime, returning only as an old man. That stretch of the play is what I've used in my Ocean Voyage. The 40 years where he's absent from Norway and travels the world, travels the globe, settling in every continent in turn, making a fortune, losing a fortune, love affairs, the years pass, never quite forgetting the guilt and shame of his youth that drove him into this exile, always with thoughts of returning, and finally, as an old man, returning to face up to the consequences of his youth, of his past, of his misdeeds, face up to his native land, and see what remains for him there. So my slice of the great big play is that Ibsen's fourth act, which takes place outside Norway altogether. And you know what Ibsen said to Grieg when Grieg was writing that famous incidental music for production? He said, why don't we miss out Act 4 altogether? Why don't you instead write a great big symphonic poem depicting Pierre's voyage around the world as he ages 40 years? And of course, Grieg did not do that. But I've picked up that hint and, in my own kind of way, filled in that enormous gap.
Indeed. Now, I'd like to mention that your contribution to this work, it's actually several composers going to be represented. Mm-hmm. Michael Tilson-Thomas has hand-selected all the darkest music he could find by not only the most familiar Edvard Grieg, but also Alfred Schnittke to tell this tale. Your contribution is nothing less than cinematic in scope, and it chronicles his 30-year trek across the globe with a gigantic score. Let me just share the orchestration that you're using. 4 flutes, 1 doubling piccolo, 3 oboes, English horn, 3 clarinets, bass clarinet, 3 saxophones, 3 bassoons, contrabassoons, 6 horns, 4 trumpets, 1 doubling piccolo trumpet, 4 trombones, 2 tubas, bass tuba, timpani, tam-tam, bass drum, cymbals, scissor cymbals, gong, iron chains, maracas, wind machine, flexitones, triangle, jingles, rattles, claves, anvil, train whistle, snare drum, side drum, tenor drum, tambourine, glockenspiel, vibraphone, xylophone, marimba, celeste, piano, 2 harps, and strings. Now, how on earth do you keep track of that?
Well, I wrote this piece back in the 1980s.
Okay.
And it's Peer Gynt's Ocean Voyage is but a small part of a total Peer Gynt that I wrote.
All right.
Back in the 80s, without commission, without hope of performance, with hope, but no likelihood of it. I just wanted to do it so much, and I thought, if I don't do this now, while I'm young and full of juice, I never will. So I better do it now, and to hell with the consequences.
So what drew you to the story, then?
Well, it's the fascination of Peer Gynt, the character, Peer Gynt, the story, this mixture of fairy tale and mythology and folklore with profound psychology. And it's one of the great European stories. So, of course, I was drawn to that. But the one section that is being played, the only bit that I've ever heard yet, is the bit without voices, without actors or singers or chorus or dance or mime. It's a multimedia work, but this is the section which is just for purely for orchestra. And the orchestra, as you say, is gigantic. The subject is gigantic. You need a range of color and sonority to render these things.
Well, you can hear some of the excerpts of this massive work, this collaborative work, at the sfsymphony.org website. The performances of the Peer Gynt extravaganza run next week, the 17th, 18th, and 19th. MTD conducts Peer Gynt. It's music of not only my guest Robin Holloway, but also Alfred Schnittke and Edvard Grieg, based on Henrik Ibsen's Peer Gynt. Robin, I want to thank you so much for taking just a brief amount of time to share with us. It sounds like it's going to be quite a production.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry I couldn't bring Schnittke, Grieg, and Ibsen along as well.
Nonetheless, we can hear them next week. Thank you, Robin.
You certainly can. Thank you.
Naima Jarvi, conducting the Berlin Philharmonic from Peer Gynt Suite by Edvard Grieg in the Hall of the Mountain King. That work no doubt being included as part of the selection of works that Michael Tilson Thomas is presenting next week and for the San Francisco production of, multimedia production of Peer Gynt, which will also include the music of Alfred Schnittke and my guest, Robin Holloway. I'm David Lotulip, and you're listening to Open Air here on KALW San Francisco. Peter Robinson joins me in just a moment.
Lord Boromir,
Lord Sicket,
and Lord Kemp.
With every virtue, every grace, of what avails the scepter's race? Here you see the four of us, and there are so many more of us, eldest sons, that must succeed. We know how Caesar conquered Gaul and how to whack a cricket ball. Apart from this, our education lacks coordination, though we're young and sensitive, and rather representative styles of a noble breed. We are the products of those homes serene and stately, which only lately seem to have run to seed. The stately homes of England, how beautiful they stand, to prove the upper classes.
And with Noel Coward's The Stately Homes of England, I introduce once again the stately and proper Peter Robinson to join us here on Open Air.
Thank you, David. Thank you for the introduction.
Yes, we chose that for a reason, because I think you are one, like many millions of folks on, I guess, both this and the other side of the pond, fans of Downton Abbey.
Yeah, and I say Downton Abbey because I actually was at a party the other day and people were referring to it as Downtown Abbey. I had to jump in and say that's not how we say it over there.
It's interesting you should say that, Peter, because in your email to me, you did mention Downtown Abbey.
I did.
You did. Well, it was probably a slip of some sort, a rare slip from the literary Peter Robinson.
Well, so much for texting.
So tell, are you going to talk about the upcoming season or what?
Yes, I did see the most recent series, which opened this last Sunday on Masterpiece Theatre, and it's beginning of a story where we've actually moved. It opened originally with the original series, with the sinking of the Titanic. We went through World War One. We got into the Spanish flu or epidemic, and now we're into the 1920s. And when I say England meets America, this is a very typical story, which even in that Stately Homes of England piece by Noel Coward, the British have the title and the castle, but the Americans have the money. Mm. And
that's part of the problem of this whole story, I believe.
That is the essence of the story, what you can buy and what a title costs you. So Lord Grantham, who...
But nonetheless, one cannot buy into the class, which is part of the conflict that's going on in the story, right?
That's right. That is the essence of the story, an observation of the class system. So Hugh Bonneville, who plays the Earl of Grantham, is married to Elizabeth, who is the American wife, Cora. And she has the money. The house really is dependent on that income. And so that is the beginning of the story. But it's not exactly new, because I hark back to a line in an old Gilbert and Sullivan opera. And this person in the opera asks a member of a House of Lords, he says, "Tell me, sir," he said to the member of the House of Lords, "what do you do?" And the House of Lords says, "Nothing in particular, but I do it particularly well." And I think...
Do? Yes, what does one do?
And I think this is really the story of Downton Abbey, that it is in many ways historically accurate. They've been very careful with the settings. They've been careful with the dialogue. And, of course, the butler, who is really the key character after the Earl, Mr. Carson, who is always referred to as Mr. Carson, is the highest end of the downstairs section. So here we are in a world where class counts for everything. The actual finances of the family are tricky, And behind that comes other ingredients. So in this series, the Irish Free State, the setting up of a conflict between the Brits and the Irish is there in one of the marriages where one of the daughters has married the chauffeur, who is an ardent supporter of Sinn Féin. So we have a new political angle to this. And at the heart of the story are some of the great one-liners from Maggie Smith. And she plays the role of the dowager, that is the mother of Robert Crawley, the Earl. And in one particular scene, as they go into a gala event, both the Earl and Matthew discover that they have not got the right type of shirt. So they have to wear tuxedos instead of tails. And with the tuxedo comes a black tie. And Maggie Smith turns to the Earl and says, "Oh my God," she said, "I mistook you for a waiter." And these little nuances, I think, are both funny and telling. Now, the series has caught on both in England and in this country.
Apparently the writer and creator Julian Fellowes really based a lot of his historical past on these characters. So in his near or distant past, it's all coming out of his own life experience.
Yeah, well, I know Julian Fellowes. In fact, I hate to say it, I was at school with him, and he actually sets the story in West Yorkshire. And a lot of the little villages which are mentioned, like Thirsk and Easingwold, are all part of his own background. So he's done his research. And I think this is really important, because if you're putting out what in fact is an English soap opera with titles, to make it authentic and to bring these characters to life, you really want to make sure the setting is and does count for everything.
One of the additions to this new season is the wonderful actress Shirley MacLaine, who's playing the mother of the Earl,
The mother of the Cora.
Of Cora,
right. Yeah. And I think in her case, I've got to say that she was a little OTT. She was a little over the top.
Shirley MacLaine over the top?
Yes, this was an unusual. But there's a very nice scene towards the end, and I don't think it ruins the story, where they suddenly find out they're going to have the elaborate dinner. So she is going to bring a picnic indoors and do it American style. And the evening finishes with her leading a chorus of an old song called "Let Me Call You Sweetheart." It's actually quite a moving piece. Interesting enough, the song was popular in 1921. It had been written in 1910. And in fact, it actually had a San Francisco connection, because on the sheet music, the lady on the front was in fact here in San Francisco, and she was the victim of a falsely accused assault by Fatty Arbuckle. And that led to a series of court cases where he was cleared, but unfortunately his reputation was ruined. But I found it very moving. Sometimes I think music in these series can reach you in emotional ways where maybe the words don't. So Let Me Call You Sweetheart brought this series to an end. And it did remind me of a movie I've seen recently called White House on the Hudson with
Hyde Park on the Hudson. And I was just going to mention that, because you mentioned the indoor picnic at Downton Abbey. It kind of dovetailed into Hyde Park on the Hudson.
Yeah. Bill Murray plays FDR. But I felt in this particular one, where they do have a picnic, as you just said, you know, the George VI, who's visiting, hoping to elicit American support for the war, it's set in 1939, he actually is frightened of eating hot dogs. And so we have a little...
Well, I believe that it was the Queen that was concerned that it would be demeaning to...
Yes, because a man of his stature doesn't rise to a sausage inside a sandwich, otherwise called a hot dog. They kind of play it to the hilt. But once again, I felt the connection in that music, in that movie, was the music. There is a wonderful scene where they're playing I Want to Set the World on Fire. And again, it's a very touching scene. But back to Downton. Highly recommend the series. I think anybody who enjoys a little bit of history, dressed up in absolutely excellent costumes, and a family drama in the best sense, will get plenty out of it. And I should also mention briefly, I went to the opening night last night of Anything Goes.
As did I.
And, well, David and I met just after the intermission. Mm-hmm. And I've got to say, that tap dancing number of Anything Goes brought the audience to their feet.
And I understand your critique of tap dancing comes with a certain degree of personal knowledge, shall we say.
Well, let's say that I have a pair of tap dancing shoes. They haven't been over-exercised, but it's certainly got my feet and my ankles moving. If you're looking for a great Cole Porter piece, it's got some of the great songs. I Get a Kick Out of You, Anything Goes, You're So Nice to Come Home To. They really are doing a fine job, and it's playing at the Golden Gate Theatre. It's got a four-week run. It's just opening, and I think this makes for a great night out.
Indeed. Here's something from Anything Goes, the great Louis Armstrong singing.
My story is much too sad to be told, but practically everything leaves me totally cold. Yes, the only exception I know is the case when I'm out on a quiet spree, fighting vainly the old ennui, and I suddenly turn and see you. Fabulous face. Yes, I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol doesn't thrill me at all. So tell me, why should it be true, babe? I get a kick out of you. Some get a kick from cocaine, babe. I'm sure that if I took even one sniff, that would bore me to riff. Liquid juice. Oh, baby, I get a kick out of you.
And with Louis Armstrong, we conclude this week's edition of Open Air. My thanks to contributor Peter Robinson and to Neil Swinkles for production assistance. I'm David Latulippe. Join me next week at 1 on Thursday for All Things Culturally Considered here on KALW Open Air.